Let's see if I can turn my timer on. Cool. All right, welcome everyone. Welcome to Kilimanjaro. It seems really nice that they have these 4D theaters in Holland, that they actually turn the heat up like you were in Kilimanjaro. Love it. I've heard that they've already asked the organizers to turn on the air conditioning, so. It was the same. Okay, was it? Yeah, but only in Kilimanjaro.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So Antarctica is like freezing as hell.
I think so.
Yeah. So I'm from Finland, so that would have been better for me. But okay, welcome to this session. This session is called Black Belt Troubleshooting Windows 8.1. My name is Sami Laiho. I'm from Finland. We're going to spend the next 75 minutes going through some troubleshooting that I'd say about... Although it's titled Troubleshooting Windows 8.1, I'd say about 90% of troubleshooting techniques go well with Windows 7 as well. So, who am I? As I said, my name is Sami Laiho, and I'm from Finland. I'm an MVP in the Windows Core OS. I'm also part of a group called STEP, if you've been reading Springboard. We're behind those articles and events that they host. I've got my own company. I do about 50% of time training, and about 50% of the time is consulting. As I got my own company, I can pick up my own titles. That's the best thing about it. So perhaps some of you know that the, at least for me, the top guru at Microsoft, Mark Rusinovich, is only a technical fellow. That's why I'm a senior technical fellow. So that's the good thing about owning your own company. If you want to follow me on Twitter, please do. I actually just found the hashtag for this event about an hour ago, so I didn't have that much time to promote. But let's go forward. I'm also a scuba diving instructor. This is a picture from my first ever XP deep dive. It was done about 10 meters below the surface of the Atlantic Ocean. And at least as far as I know, it's the first and only XP certification that's ever been done below the surface. The students were okay with this, but the IBMs at that time didn't make it. But that sure was really fun. A few of my projects, you can check those out later if you wish. I've got my blog site there, and my own company is called Adminize. I've also, one of the reasons why I'm an MVP is because I did a software for free called Vioski, which is a replacement for Steady State. I was responsible for the Windows 7 deployment for the capital of Finland, Helsinki, and they couldn't go through with the actual deployment before they had something to replace steady state at libraries and stuff like that. So you can check it out if you wish. Just to establish a baseline here, as I said, I'm from Finland, so English is totally not my native language. So just bear with me if I'm trying to translate my Finnish jokes to English somehow. Some of them work, some of them don't. Just to set the stage here, as most people around the world get something at least resembling to administrator, or the Swedish get administratör. In Finland, when we do debugging, we have to use this. That's actually quite easy to pronounce. It's called järjestelmävalvoja. You use that when you actually log on to, for example, a local DC, when you have to do it. I actually did some investigation on this. I found an official KP article telling about 107 languages that Windows has, and only 8 countries have decided to actually translate the username. Almost all translate the display name, but the actual username gets only translated in these 8 languages. And it's quite easy to see that Finnish and Hungarian are the only relative languages here, so even I can't pronounce the Hungarian there. That makes your life a bit hard, because when you do gpedit.msc to get a group policy object editor in the Finnish UI, it looks like this. Many times when someone asks me about, do you have difficulties presenting in English, I'm telling them about trying to translate my jokes from Finnish to English. And just to make you sure about the difficulties we are having, I've actually had here displaying the different words for dog in Finnish. You have to learn those at school. Actually, I'm not even stopping yet, because there's a lot more. There's about something like 370 different words for a dog. Just to make you come to Finland, it's easy. Start it. It's easy. We learned it at like 3 years old. So. Okay. I also got the coolest t-shirts you can get, which are the official Järjestelmävalvoja t-shirts. Stick around. I will exchange these to business cards. If you got them, stick around. I've got about 25 different... Oh, I've got about 4 sizes and 25 pieces, so just fast. First, who are the fastest can get them. But yeah, that's about it. So let's go to the topic at hand. What we're going to go through are some baselines first, then we're going to talk about error messages and go through some demos, go through user accounts, which are the appropriate ones for troubleshooting. Then we're going to go through pre-logon diagnostics, services, processes and threads, safe mode tweaking, and a few words about blue screens in Windows 8.1. Just to establish a few baselines, I always teach my students, the first thing I teach them is that if you're trying to find a logic in Windows, the only logic in Windows is that there is actually no logic. There's a few examples here. Most of you probably know this. You know that all your boot files are on the system partition, and all your system files are on your boot partition. All the 64-bit code goes to System32, and all the 32-bit code goes to SysSwap64. If you're trying to debug something called SMB, Server Message Block Protocol, you have to tweak the parameters for a service in the registry. I actually spent about a day trying to find and get it to work, but then you realize that you actually have to type the parameters below a registry key called Bowser and not Browser, because they mistyped it. Just last week, I met the guy first time in real life who was responsible for a WinSock protocol or driver for Windows in the beginning of NT. And the guy had a driver ready, and then the boss asked them, like, why aren't you publishing the driver? Why isn't it ready? So he said that it's actually ready, but they just don't have a name for it. So then the guy running the show yelled at them that it's just another freaking driver. And that's why it's called AFD, still to this day. And I'll bet you it's not freaking, but I can't say the word. Here. If you try to load up files into the registry, so you try to open up a registry file in the regedit, you have to open up a hive. And that's kind of weird, because hives, actually the first thing that comes to mind is a beehive. And that's actually what it is. So does it like reassemble the structure of the registry somehow? No way. The guy who was building up the block to get the files opened up in the registry editor was actually scared to death of bees. So Dave Cutler, who was running the show at that time, he thought that the guy was circling around his project, like trying to stay away from a beehive. So then Dave Cutler named them hives. So those are just like examples on what you're dealing with when you're trying to troubleshoot the OS itself. Every single thing has to be learned by heart or by reading a manual. There's no way of trying to figure out something like, it makes common sense that if this works in this way, then this should work in this way. That's the good thing about PowerShell, if you think about it. I just met Jeffrey Snower a few weeks ago and talked to him a lot about it. And he said that people at Microsoft really wanted him to build a super command prompt. Like the old days, we had 4 DOS. So that's just like build up a super command prompt rather than start everything from the beginning. And he insisted that they will have to build up an empty shell with rules, and then people can start building up stuff on top of PowerShell. And it's a really good thing that he had this in mind and actually went through with it. Because now when you stop a service and you know how to use it, you know that if you want to stop a process, you know it's stop process. If you do that in CMD, sc stop service name, task kill dash im notepad.exe dash force. So there's like those two have nothing in common. You have to learn every single one by heart. Okay, some tools that we're going to use during this session. So every single computer, if you ask me, should have these three. So you need the sysinternals tools. You need debugging tools, not so much for debugging itself or using WinDBG, but more as a support for sysinternals tools. So for example, Process Explorer requires debugging tools to show you everything that you need. So it's not that you would do debugging itself, but you need it for sysinternals. Then there's Message Analyzer, Network Monitor, which was renamed to Message Analyzer a year ago, 2 years ago. If you got Windows 8.1, not even Windows 8, but Windows 8.1 has a really cool feature that you can actually do remote network monitoring with Message Analyzer. So if you got 8.1 on the other end, you can just remotely network monitor the computer. You can capture traces with the previous ones, 7 and 8. There's NetSH trace syntax that can be used to capture, and then when after you've captured it, then you diagnose it somewhere else. But to do live remote network monitoring, then you have to have 8.1. Two most common mistakes in troubleshooting that we're going to go through here. First of all, people think that administrators can see everything as they compare the built-in administrator to Unix's root account. Although in Windows, the root account is the system account. So like, when you start to troubleshoot, usually the first thing is that you just actually can't see what the error is. You don't have permissions to do it. And then there's the common thing that people think that processes do something, as processes in Windows by design can't do anything, as processes are only like sandboxes for threads. So there's nothing that a process can actually execute. It doesn't execute functions, for example. Threads do that. But when you start doing troubleshooting, the first thing you need to have are good error descriptions. This might be, if it's a black belt session, you might not expect to have this, as it seems quite simple. But this is something that I absolutely, every single time when I have a session or if I have a customer, and I try to have some time just to train them on how to capture errors, just to make the help desk people's jobs a little bit easier. The worst one that you get most often, of course, is that they just know that the computer just broke. They don't have any idea on what happened. They're actually quite good at knowing when it still worked, especially because it's somehow built into end users that it's your fault that it doesn't work anymore. So they're quite good at it. Like last Tuesday, everything was working fine. But they don't know what happened. So this is the worst, and then the, I don't know if we should say the best or the worst or the most fun one, but I actually have an actual screenshot of a piece of paper that was delivered to my desk when I was still working in help desk, and it's here. I'd say if you know your blue screens, you know it's NT4 time frame. Still with the hex values down there. I'd call it dedication. Like, you've actually asked them to give you proper error descriptions, and I honestly didn't know what to say. I was like, thank you, or yeah. But then I was like looking at it. I was like, "There's actually a typo in it." But I didn't go through with that, so I just thanked him and tried to figure out what was going on. So, just a few examples on capturing errors. So we're going to go through a few demos here. Let's change to a virtual machine. And first of all, a really, really simple and old one, which still seems to be forgotten. Let's change this. Whenever I'm running a session that gets recorded, as this one does, I always thank a friend of mine called Jukka. Because Jukka is like really good with all commands and really good with different shortcut keys and stuff like that. And whenever he uses his command prompt, I'm using this command prompt now to make you see what I'm typing. But whenever Jukka does this, he actually changes this to black on black and calls it the ninja mode. Because when you really know your stuff, you don't actually have to see anything. But what I'm going to do is change it to black on white so you can see it. Okay. My user's name is first name. That's that was actually really funny because I thought this was a really good joke, but now I'm really struggling with it because let's see this. Oh, that's actually the... Here we go. Let's sign in. Because can you figure out how tough it is for me to receive any email now? Because I actually tried to be funny, but now whenever someone asks me, like, what's your email address? It's firstname.lastname@live.fi. And then they call me, like, I just sent 10 messages to sami.laiho@live.fi. No. F-I-R-S-T. Supposed to be a good one. Now it's turning against me. Yeah, it is. You can try it. First name dot last name. That's not what I was going to show you. I was going to show you NetHelp MSG, which is the first one. It just translates the error code numbers to text. So people seem to think that we know all the codes by heart. So they can contact help desk. Like, I just got the error message 12. It's like, oh, that one. Sure. So that's an old one. Incorrect function. Whenever I have a hands-on lab on this, people doing this on a lab, they always, at least a few students, always raise their hands and like, the command is not working really well because I get an incorrect function. Like, yeah, you should. So zero is everything's okay. There's also a new one called WinRM Help MSG, which can translate hex codes. Might be, if you know them by heart. You don't have to know these by heart. There's only a few ones you have to know by heart. For example, if you're going to a company party, you have to remember, all the guys have to remember this, that the replication with a non-configured partner is not allowed. So you honestly don't have to know all by heart, but some you do. Yeah. If you go back home and you're drunk, there's a few ones with an invalid handle on your door and stuff like that, but... Okay. So that's a good one. Then if you have, like, any... If you try to open up something that results in an error dialog, I don't know why they don't have, like, a nice button next to it, but if you try to open this one and you get an error dialog, then you remember that you can always press Ctrl-C, then open up your email account, for example, email app, and then Ctrl-V. I don't know why they don't have a copy-paste button next to it, but all error dialogs can do Ctrl-C, Ctrl-V in Windows. If that's not good enough, then since Windows 7, you also had the snipping tool. This is super funny because a student of mine, this always happens to me that when I'm running a course, students at some time get to teach me. And that's one of the best things about this profession. So, one of them was that I was trying to tell them that if you're running, for example, if I'm trying to do screenshots for different user manuals or user labs, then the bad thing is that you actually can't capture these menus. As you press the snipping tool new, you can't open up a menu. And then there was a student of mine sitting in the front row like, have you read the help file? Sure, I haven't. Almost in the beginning of the help file, it says that if you now press escape, then you open up, for example, a menu, and then you press control print screen, then you can capture menus as well. Aha, he got me there. All people don't read help files. Some do. I actually found a software on the internet about a few months ago. It was this virtual CD software, and I was laughing for the whole day after reading an email that they sent us, because they sent an email to their customers that after 3 years, for the first time, someone has actually read their end-user license agreement. Because in the end of the EULA that they have, it says that if you read this far, you can actually download this software for free from our website. And now they had the first download after 3 years. So they have proof. They have actual proof that it took 3 years for the first customer to read the licensing. That's cool. If that's not good enough, then you have something called the PSR. So Problem Steps Recorder, which was introduced in Windows 7 and now works in a bit different way. So you can just start recording, and then you have a user who's trying to, for example, change the font size or something like that, so he can just show you what he's doing and show that he can change italic, bold italic, and then he can add a comment. This one here. Can't resize. Okay. And then just stop recording. And for example, if you have an email client, then there's actually an email button next to the save one, so they can just email it straight away. Or you can look at the file with this built-in viewer of what he did. And if that's not good enough and you really want to get into the mood, then you can just review the recorded steps as a slideshow. Why is it a slideshow and why it's so good that it's a slideshow? It's because the user can actually spend like 30 minutes thinking about the next step he did to produce the problem. And the file won't get any bigger. As if you would have a video, it would just grow and grow and grow and grow. But this one won't grow a bit if you don't do anything. You can also use this to create help files or instructions, manuals, documentation. All right. Then there's, I think those are the ones that we're going to go through now. So let's change back to the slides. Did I go through everything? Well, Windows print screen, if you need new screenshots of modern apps and stuff like that, then there's the new quick button of Windows print screen. User accounts in troubleshooting. One of the biggest faults, especially with Windows 8.1, is the thing that people tend to think that administrators can actually do most all of the stuff, but they can only do most of the stuff. So there's stuff that they don't have to worry about, which are like policies, but administrators have to obey policies if they don't block them themselves, but system doesn't have to obey policies in the beginning. System also doesn't have to worry about something called the mandatory integrity control, which is a new one even in Windows Vista, although almost no one is talking about it. We'll take a look at that also. There's processes that admins can't stop. There's services that admins can't stop. There's lots of stuff that the administrator can't see. Mandatory integrity control is something that I would love to have a session on it, because it seems that although it was introduced in Windows Vista, still no one seems to be familiar with it. But if you've ever heard someone tell you that IE7 had something built in called the protected mode, and they said that protected mode is a lot more safe in Vista than in XP. The reason why is just here, because Vista introduces something called the mandatory integrity control and integrity levels. So all processes have integrity levels, which are from low to system. Actually, there's six of these, but you can only control four of them: low, medium, high, and system. And then every resource has the same thing. And Windows, by default, states that a process running at a higher level can write to resources running on a lower level. But a process running on a lower level cannot affect a resource running on a higher level. For example, if you're running IE, you cannot... With the IE that you're browsing with, you actually can't save any files. That sounds stupid, doesn't it? Because you know that if you download a PDF, you can save it to your documents. If you've ever wondered why your user profiles look like this, if you go to the only, nowadays only application data, and it has these folders below it: local, local, low, and roaming. Roaming takes everything that is transferred with the roaming profile, and then local and local low stay on your computer, although you would be running a roaming profile. Local is running with the integrity level of medium, and local low is running with the integrity level of low. When you start up Internet Explorer, and you go to Process Explorer here, and check out the integrity level on the right-hand side, so we can find the IE run by this user, you can actually see that you are running two IEs. The parent process is the one that can actually save to your documents, because your documents is running medium integrity level. And the one that you are using for your browsing is actually running low. So even though you would be running administrative rights, bypassing UAC, doing everything that you shouldn't be doing, it would still protect you from writing to most of your resources. That's also the reason why your administrators cannot destroy stuff from program files or Windows directory and places like that. So whenever you find a file nowadays in the supported Windows, now that we've got rid of XP support, so with the supported Windows versions, if you can't delete a file, and you absolutely know that you should be, everything that you've been taught about Windows security states that you should be able to delete it, then there's two options. The most common one, about 90%, is because you don't own it, because it's owned by a service called the Trusted Installer. So you just first take own and then destroy it. But if you still cannot destroy it, then it's about integrity levels. And then you have to use iCaggles. So if you thought iCaggles was iCaggles at Microsoft only because of iPad and iPhone doing so well, it's not iCaggles for the obvious reason. It's I for integrity. So I for integrity. How do we run with the system account? Let's try. So first of all, we'll show you here. This is a normal command prompt. I'm running someone called demo. And CMD control shift enter, which is the shortcut for elevated rights. Let's click yes. Who am I? /all. First of all, this guy has lots of privileges. And also, you can find something here, which is called mandatory label, high mandatory level. If you compare it to a normal command prompt, your admin who is not running elevated is running with the medium. If you want to get past that, you need more. So first of all, let's try old stuff that I always usually show. So for example, an administrator account has no access to the local security account database or the security hive, the beehives, as we spoke. So the beehives here are secured. If you try to enter, for example, the one we already mentioned, so system volume information access is denied. Even one of the weirdest things, if you go to a task scheduler and think about Windows 8.1, Microsoft changed the way group policy client works totally compared to Windows 7. In Windows 7, group policy client was running all the time. Windows 8.1, it's actually frozen whenever it's not doing anything. And They changed it so that now instead of waiting all the time for 90 plus 0 to 30 minutes for the group policy refresh, they actually inject a scheduled task. Yet there's nothing here. Okay? So let's try the same thing after PSExec. So PSExec, it's dash S, dash I, dash, dash D. So it has nothing to do with the SID, if you think about security identifiers. cmd.exe. Here we go. Who am I? Now we're running a system. We also have a lot more privileges than admins have. And we also have the mandatory label of system. So we can access files that admins can't, even the built-in. If we now try to go into places we saw before, like the system volume information, it opens up. If you open up regedit, regedit, you can actually go and figure out what's wrong with your security hive or the SAM database. If you open up task scheduler, go here. And you can see the hidden tasks as well. So how would you debug something that you can't see? Another cool thing about Windows is something that was in the beginning built for their own people working at the product support services. And it was meant for the ability to open up debuggers without customers seeing it. So you need to be able to, when you're diagnosing something that something that's happening before the log on, you have to be able to log on before anyone logs on. So the coolest thing in Windows, it's something called the image execution file options, which is image file execution options, which is very often used for cracking, but can be used for good as well. And it's also very good to play with your friends. So let's go here. Software, Microsoft, Windows NT, current version, image file execution options. You might have seen this in action if you've ever used Process Explorer and chosen the option to replace Task Manager. That's the thing it uses. So what you can do here is you can inject a new key. Let's call it, for example, Notepad. And then instead of running Notepad, we actually give it a debugger, which is called the calculator. So now whenever someone tries to open up a Notepad, they always get a calculator. It's really nice. Wouldn't it be cool for your friends? So they would, if they wanted to use Notepad, they would actually have to go to Windows, System 32, Notepad, right-click, and open. And no, not even there. It's stronger than any path variables or anything like that. So, okay, we won't use it for that. But now that we know that works, what we'll do is we'll figure out what are the processes that are running on the computer even if no one has logged on. For example, we could use, let's do this with the display switch.exe. So that's the Windows P. You know that when you press Windows P, okay? So if you press Windows P, oh no, now we get a calculator. Okay? So we're getting there. Now let's change this debugger value to cmd.exe. So when we press Windows P, we get a command prompt. And now that we haven't logged on, we can always use the Windows P to log on.
This is also the trick how to rename your admin password.
Yes, exactly. Same thing. So what we can do now is whatever we need. So what tools you need. So you just use you're using the system account, so do be careful. As he said, it's running with full privileges, so you can also, of course, change passwords and stuff. There's even a hacker on my computer now. Don't know why. Okay. So one of the most common ones that I use is actually Process Monitor. So I can open up a process monitor and monitor what's happening during logons and stuff like that. But it's more of a, let's say, it's a concept. It's not a pre-built way of getting rid of your errors, but it's something at the base level that you have to know how to do to be able to do troubleshooting. Okay? First name, not last. All right. And if that wasn't enough, then you can always try autoruns. That's one thing that's very cool, very good with logons. I actually figured out a new thing. This was something I came up just a few months ago. And I've got the sysinternals tools here somewhere. Let's try to find them here, sysint. So someone actually called me. I have a company that I take care of in Finland as well. It's a small clothing factory. And a sales person called me and told me that she had probably been infected with malware. And I asked her why, and she said that now whatever she tries to do on the internet, there's a pop-up that says that Internet Security 2013 would like to save your behind. So I said, yeah, probably. Sounds like an infection. I know that they're not running admin rights, so it's probably not that bad. What I did was I actually remoted into it with TeamViewer, and instead of logging on with her user account, I logged on using my own user account, and because I don't know her password, and I don't want to reset it. So what I actually did was auto run shift right click and run as different user, and then asked her to type in the username that she uses with her computer. So what you actually get is a, let's say, simulation of what would happen if this user would log on. So instead of anything opening up or infecting the computer even more, you just get the simulation of what would happen. So now it's easy to fix before she logs on. I asked her about where she got the infection, where had she been browsing at on the internet, and she said that only at the City of Helsinki's website. I was like, yeah, sure. Mm. Yes, we all know that. Mm. No, nowhere else. No. Yeah, sure. Mm. Thank you. Bye-bye. And I was like, ha, ha, ha. But you know what I wasn't really, what I didn't expect was a honest end user. I didn't know that we had those, but we really do, because when I went, just for the fun of it, I went to Helsinki's website, and it actually was pointing straight to Ukrainian website somewhere. It had been hijacked. So she was actually telling the truth, that she had only been browsing on the City of Helsinki's website. Autoruns, and if you want to dig even deeper, then you get the Windows Performance Toolkit, which is a really, really cool tool since the past few years. Before that, it was horrible to use. Now it's a lot better. So what we can see here is an example of a real authentic situation that I was dealing with. Here we have a logon that uses about 400 seconds total. And after getting rid of the slower components that they had during logon, now we're down to about 180. It's something that it's really easy for a consultant to sell and also invoice, because you can easily count that, even because this company had 6,000 users. So if you count it like 6,000 times a few minutes, then a few hours of consulting doesn't cost that much. I've got an even better example here. A stuck service. So they had actually just recently installed an inventory service. So you can get this one here, appservice.exe, which is an inventory software. And you can find out easily with the performance toolkit that it actually takes this amount of time for this single service to open up. So it took actually, it says it somewhere here, execution ended at 250, so about 220 seconds. It says it somewhere here. Service init time, 213 seconds for a single service, malfunctioning service. So got rid of it and logons back to normal. Now that we're talking about services, you always have to remember that when something's wrong with services, there's basically two things that go wrong. The other one is that it's a security issue or something else. Most of them are security issues, over 50%, or something else for the rest, 50%. What I usually do is I create a user account which is not part of the administrators group. I know this takes for ages, and this is actually a demo that I wasn't intending to even show you because it takes so long, but just in case that we will finally get it up and running, I'll show it to you at that time. Why is it taking so long? It's because I'm running a direct access connection back home, so I know it's taking a while. Anyway, we can use a user account that doesn't belong to the local administrators group, and then you add the user the same permissions that the administrators group has. What am I talking about? I'm talking about user rights assignment here. Why would I do it? I would inject this new user that I create, I would inject it to everywhere that administrators have rights assigned straight to the user. So when I log on with the user, I have an easy way of knowing if it has something to do with this. If you would put it in the administrators group, then you wouldn't know because it might be because of file or registry permissions as well. So you have to have a user account which is not administrators group member and then inject it here. If that's not the case, then you have to also monitor. So a good trick is to use process monitor and just use a process monitor filter with the process ID value that you can get with sc.exe. So you can monitor what the service is trying to do. If you're trying to do proper monitoring, it's many times because of user permissions anyway. So what you do is actually open up process monitor. And on top of running the... I'm not sure if I'm running it already. Probably. Here we go. So on top of doing the filter for the process ID, you can also do a filter. You have to do this by hand. It's not in any drop-down menus. So you type it manually. Result is access denied. Because then you will see line by line whenever something ends up with a permission problem. Same thing that I use for software that are not working without admin rights. Okay? So for example, if I was running this, what could we do? We could do, is that the system account? Let's try this. So system volume information access is denied. Let's try this a few times like this. And then we can open up process monitor so you can see whenever you get an access denied, then you know who was trying to do what with and where. If you're getting to harder problems with services, you have to become a service. Now we're getting to the ninja part, you know, the Jedi stuff. To become a service. I always remember when I started learning networking back 20 years ago, I had a teacher that I had so much fun because he was always referring to DNS servers as he or she. So when he was teaching, he would always refer to, like, now he is transferring the zone to her. And, well, that sounded fun, but when I started talking about services, I realized that that's actually the case. You have to learn to treat services as users. Services are referred to he or she, so we have two services called local service and network service. These are actually part of the local users group. So they don't have almost any rights on the local computer. And then there's one called system. And these two are referred to as he, because they can't really decide anything. And then there's her. She can actually do whatever she wants. Now that this is getting recorded, I'd like to say hi to my wife. There's also a difference when these services start interacting with network. So if you are running a local service, it's a normal user on the local computer and uses a null session when talking to the network. So no user ID, no password. Then you have network service and system. When they talk outside of your computer, they are using the computer account from Active Directory. if you are part of Active Directory domains. Okay. So that was the thing even in Windows XP. This was introduced after Windows 2000, which always used system for all services by default. So XP introduced these lower privilege levels, local service and network service. That's not enough. You know that you still have to do a lot of service accounts for services. So you do user accounts for SAP or something like that. So you have a service and then you do a user account because you have to have the ability to give it exact permissions to a file or folder or something like that. And that gets quite tedious. So now we can also have services as security principals. In Windows, security principal is someone who can be given permissions to or taken permissions from. So now you can actually make a service a security principal. And a security principal in Windows needs a SID, a security identifier. And now all services have security identifiers. Not visible straight from the UI, but you can use your command prompt to figure them out. So SC show SID spooler or Bowser. Now this is the only one that I have to look from my notes because this is really, really hard. There's also a, let's see, this should be something new to you, but something that you've heard people talk about a lot during the last few days. So show SID. NSA Heartbleed, but that's 067. That's kind of weird as people are still saying that NSA didn't know about Heartbleed, although we have a service in Windows. So probably now most of you hopefully get it, that it doesn't actually test if the service actually exists. So you can type in whatever you want. So you could have spooler, which would have a SID as well. So it just figures out the SID from the string that you type in. Okay. So it's really fun to play around with your friends, you know. Secret Prism Listener. Wow! Okay. So you see these services quite often if you look at Windows 7 or 8 because there's a trusted installer, for example. That's a service. And you can give NT service spooler rights to, for example, write into a certain directory instead of changing the spooler to use a user account that you just created. So it makes the administering a lot easier. That was actually the demo, so gone through that. Then there's processes and threads, okay? In Windows, processes can't really do anything, and then there's the worst software ever built in the human history called Task Manager. And Task Manager can't even show you what is actually doing something in Windows. Task Manager gets a lot better in the current Windows, so the new Task Manager is a lot better than the old one, but it's still lacking a fundamental thing of being able to show you threads. It can only show you the number of threads. So for example, I'm always playing with my friends, telling them that, because if we have like a Trivial Pursuit game going on and we have to have some IT-related questions, so I always put in a question, or even in TechEd this year, I put in a question that was true or false. In Windows Vista, Explorer XE never got stuck. And you know that everyone is going to say false, because it was stuck all the time. Vista was never running. Oops, the recording stuff. So, for example, if we look at that, if we check that Explorer XE, according to Task Manager, is the one that's behaving badly, with Process Explorer, you can go to Properties, and you can go to Threads, and you can actually see the threads that are running functions, meaning that they are actually the ones to blame. Now that I'm running debugging tools, in the background you see these hex values here change the words in a while. It says loading symbols here. So it's using the symbol server from Microsoft to show you actual function names instead of numbers. Why would I do this? Well, shcore.dll, for example. Now we're in a Microsoft conference, so you can use the web browser of your choice, but you can also use your search engine of your choice. So, oh, not that one. Let's try this one. So if I would, for some reason, use Google anyway. Last time I was trying to find something called the group policy settings reference, you know, the file that has group policy settings for Windows. I was trying to find that with Google, and it's the first hit. And then I used Bing, and I got into group therapy, which is it's on their own servers. Weird. Anyway, if you try to if you say something like Explorer XE is hanging, and I'll bet you that your error is on this list. You just have to go through 580,000 results, and it'll be there. So the biggest problem with search engines nowadays is noise. You have to have more exact sentences for your queries, meaning that instead of Explorer XE is hanging, you would, for example, in Windows Vista, shell wapi.dll is hanging. About half of it got rid of. We got rid now. So that's even a bad example because it's so common. But if you have more current errors, it gets a lot better. Usually about, if you are up at 100% level, you get down to about 10 to 20%. So it's still thousands and thousands of hits. But it's not only to get rid of the noise, but it's to get in contact with the correct people. At that point, when you're talking about threads, you know that less people know about threads. And if you know about threads, it's a lot. You can be sure that they know more about Windows than the normal users do. For example, if you go to something like eventid.net, a really, really old website, which doesn't have moderation in it. So you could find I'm struggling with my Word language detection options. And then there's a answer to it which says that you just reinstall your Internet Explorer and everything works fine. And it's even an accepted solution. Just because the guy who was trying to fix it thought that when he reinstalled his IE, it somehow fixed Word. Although it doesn't have anything to do with the actual problem. So to get rid of noise, I've got an example on the slides here. This is a really new one, although as you see, the resolution was a really funny one. But I've got a VM that was totally stuck. A customer was running a VDI environment with about 1,000 virtual machines, client virtual machines. And all the VMs were behaving like this. No load on them, so there's nothing running, just the plain OS, and still every single VM is running at about 65% CPU. If we check this from the task manager, we can see that the CPU is almost, or usually if it's 40%, it's really bad. So 40% of CPU is taken by the system. But the bad thing is that that's the best you can do. You will never get past this with task manager, because task manager cannot show you the one who's actually running the functions and behaving bad. If you check out the same thing in Process Explorer, it's quite obvious. Take the system. Who's taking all its floppydisk.sys, which sounds really funny. In a current Windows Hyper-V environment, we're stuck because of floppies. But that was actually the case, because the guy who was running the virtual machine was experimenting with BitLocker. And at that time, if you wanted to have BitLocker on a virtual machine, you needed to have a virtual floppy disk to host the key. And he had it on his test machine. And then he took a copy of that VM and put it to production on another system. So every single VM was trying to read a virtual floppy disk file on the C drive. And it's like having your old floppy disk trying to read all the time, so you always can't do anything else. So really, really weird error, but a very good example of Task Manager versus Process Explorer. Quite obvious when you see this floppy disk.sys rather than seeing system. Then there's something really cool about Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 called Safe Mode. There are obvious reasons why F8 is not working anymore. Why isn't F8 work? You can get it to work, and even some computers have it working if they are running this legacy BIOS thing. But by default, in Windows 8, Windows 8.1, you can't press F8 to get to safe mode. Why? Two reasons. One, you don't have a keyboard. So Microsoft is trying to say that everyone is running a slate nowadays, a tablet rather than a computer, so with a keyboard. So you couldn't press F8 because you don't have the freaking keyboard. And another reason is that with a UEFI machine, you have a maximum of 200 milliseconds to press the key. So you would be really good if you got into safe mode. So there's a few ways to get into safe mode if you're running a running OS. You just press Shift and restart. Shift key, restart. So here, settings, Shift, and then restart, which I won't do now. That's the host machine. For example, if you want to go to your UEFI, the same thing. Or you can go to your settings, change PC settings, update and recovery, recovery, advanced startup. That will actually take you to Windows RE. If you're running a computer that's not booting up at all, then there's a default method of getting into Windows RE. So first you get an unsuccessful boot, number one, the computer reboots automatically. If you get another unsuccessful boot, it'll reboot and boot into Windows RE. If your computer's BCD store is broken, you can't get into it, so you will need an external recovery drive. Can be created from running Windows 8.1 on a USB stick, luckily not a CD anymore. Then you can ask the computer to go to advanced options, and then it will reboot you to the F8 menu. And then you can say, choose safe mode, and then you're at safe mode. So a 10-step thing to get to safe mode. Not that easy, but for obvious reasons.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, you can.
If you're running in UEFI mode, can you always boot from USB stick? Or let's say, for example, that your WinRE partition is broken?
Not always. I can tell you a real story from about 2 days. I forgot to do it. I was actually going to take a screenshot from my computer because I fixed a blue screening machine for the first time in my life with WhatsApp for my godson. He was taking pictures with WhatsApp and sending it to me, and I was telling him what to do. I was in San Francisco, and he was in Helsinki, so we were fixing a computer with WhatsApp. It's really cool. First time ever. but I did something. He couldn't boot up the machine, so I asked him if he had any CDs or DVDs that he got with the computer. He didn't know where they were. And then I asked if he had another computer. So he had his little big sister's computer. So we took the computer, and then I downloaded a Windows 8.1 media from MSDN and copied it to a USB stick, because that's one thing you can do also. So you can just, then you open up, boot it with the media, and then you say, instead of install now, you say repair. And then you get to the same point, okay?
If you have enabled secure boot.
Then, yeah, if you have enabled secure boot, the good thing is that when you use this MSDN media, for example, you can, because all the boot files are signed with the key that's the same key that's running your Windows is signed with. So you can, but why I couldn't? Because I then asked him to go to his computer, and he tried to boot with USB. And no options. So I asked him about secure boot, because I knew that you were getting there. So I asked him about secure boot, and then I even thought that it shouldn't be because of that, because it's a Microsoft-signed boot, so it should work. And I couldn't figure it out. And then we stopped and slept for the night, because we had different time zones. So then when I went to sleep, I asked him. I didn't ask him, but I figured it out. I did something that I always teach people about, but I don't remember it myself, which is the weirdest thing. We're talking about brand new computers running UEFI. Still, UEFI, the consortium behind UEFI, hasn't paid for the license to use NTFS. And what I actually did by mistake was that I formatted the USB stick with NTFS and then took the installation media and put it on the USB. So you won't be able to see it in the boot menu because UEFI cannot read NTFS. That's why all your Windows 8 machines have four different partitions. One for BitLocker, one for recovery, one NTFS for the OS itself, and then a small FAT partition. The FAT partition, the old, really, really old FAT partition, needs to exist on the brand new computers because they don't have license to read NTFS. So then next day we did a new USB stick with FAT32 and did the same thing, and then we got it up and running. So that's what you get with all these options. The external USB key with the F8, the shift restart, or the automatic one. You always end up in this. Okay. Now the weirdest thing is that you're actually missing something. Last known good configuration. Microsoft deprecated this in the earlier Windows version, and now it's gone. So there's no last known good configuration, unless you want to have it back. That's a good block, because it has all other weird options on how to get old stuff back, if you want to have them back. Last known good doesn't exist anymore. And with the safe mode, there's also something really weird, which is that people usually tell me that their computer is able to boot into safe mode, but not into normal mode. And then I ask them, so why? And they ask me, how the heck should we know? Because that's the weirdest thing. You have this safe mode, but you don't really have any good documentation on what is a safe mode. Why is it working in safe mode and not in the normal mode? What's the difference between normal and safe? That's one thing. And also the weirdest thing. Microsoft website has instructions on for people installing software that they should use this new preferred way of installing software. I'm not talking about modern apps, I'm talking about desktop software. So what's the file type that should be used for installing software? MSI, okay? So you should be using MSIs to install software. Then on the Microsoft website, it also says that if you have a bad behaving software and after installing the software, you are not able to run the computer anymore, what should you do? You should go to safe mode and uninstall it. Well, that's a really nice thing to try out. If you've ever tried it, you know. Okay? So if we have anything that's installed with, let's see what we have here. No programs installed on this computer. So I actually forgot to install anything on it, so that's a bit bad. Let's try Adobe, for example. That's something that we might need to uninstall sometime. I even said install Google Chrome. Yeah. That's insane. In this conference. Sorry for that. And the toolbars and whatever, okay? So we should get this in a bad behaving manner in a matter of minutes. We have 11 minutes to go, so we are in a bit of a hurry. It already has Chrome. I didn't put it there. Must have been someone else. In last decade, I actually, first time in my life, I saw someone thrown out of the conference because he was trying to do his demos with VMware, and he was actually thrown out of the conference. So I'm trying to behave here. That's in Finnish. It's easy for you to read as well. It says Adobe Reader is now ready. Okay, fair enough. So now we have Adobe Reader installed here. All right. Now the bad thing is that if we actually let's take this one anyway. So let's reboot this. As I said, there's a few ways of doing it. So one would be shift restart, as this is working correctly. So shift restart here. You could also use msconfig. That's a good one to know as well. Why would you use msconfig to boot something in safe mode? One obvious reason is that you can do semi-safe modes. So you can, for example, hide all Microsoft services and then disable everything that's outside of Windows. Although Windows has faults in it, usually Windows works by itself if it's not running anything else. And the good thing about booting with this into safe mode is that you can actually boot a remote machine into safe mode. That's the most obvious reason for using msconfig. You got a remote machine and you want to reboot it to safe mode. And you want to access it afterwards, but you can't access it by default because terminal services service is not running, at least by default. Okay? Now we'll use just the normal method of clicking power and shift restart. That didn't work that well. You know why?
Well, that's something to sometimes you go to those boxes and sit down and like that.
That's the reason why you can't do this on some computers. The reason is that if you've installed Windows without the Windows RE. So that's something that you can do. So if that's not possible, then you luckily still have a few options. That works as a really nice demonstration, and I was really intending to show you that. No, I wasn't. Luckily, we have msconfig, so let's go here. Safe boot, and let's go for minimal. Okay, and restart. Okay, first name dot last name is back in business with a lousier resolution, so looks good. And we're in safe mode. So why can't you take software out of a bad behaving computer? It's because, can we get this up? Oh, a bit too big of a resolution here. Yeah. Here we go. Good, thanks. That's a bit better, although not full screen, but anyway, let's go here. If you would try to uninstall something from here, why can't you do it? It's because the service of Windows Installer is not running. So let's go to services.msc. Wow. This is behaving really bad in the safe mode. MSC. Yeah, probably. Okay, here we go. So, Windows Installer, here, it's in manual, and if we start it, cannot be started in safe mode. Isn't that quite weird? You're instructed to uninstall software in safe mode, and it should be installed with MSI, but you can't uninstall anything that's installed with MSI. Luckily, there's something you can do, although Microsoft says you shouldn't. So, safe mode. To know why your computer is working in safe mode and not working in the normal mode, you will go to Control Safe Boot, because both safe modes, the minimal one and the networking one, are both configured in this register key. So at least you have a list of what is running in a safe mode, so all drivers, all services are listed here. So you can compare normal against safe. And you can also use this. So minimal, new, key, and then take the name of the driver or the service. So MSI server. And change the default value to service or driver. So service in this case. Now that you've changed that, then you can go here and start, and now you can uninstall everything. You know how I learned this? I didn't find it on the internet. I actually figured out how to do it, and it was because, I don't know if you've heard about this malware called Norton Antivirus. If you get it on your computer, you will never get it off. So you have got a 23-page instructions on how to remove it from the computer. It's a lot harder than removing malware. Sorry for any Symantec employees that just left the room. Okay, so there's a few tricks about safe mode, both to know why it's working in safe mode and also how to tweak the safe mode itself. Windows 8.1 BSOD, so blue screen of death, works in a bit different way than Windows 7, luckily. So we actually got back the option to make a complete memory dump. In Windows 7, it was taken out if you had more than 2 gigabytes of memory. So now it's back. You can do a complete memory dump. And there's also something called the automatic memory dump. So you know that memory dumps work in a way that when Windows thinks that it's better to stop doing anything than continuing if something goes wrong in the kernel mode, then it instructs the computer to create a blue screen and a memory dump. And it doesn't take any chances by opening a new file. So it uses a file that it knows that it's big enough and it's already opened. It already has a handle for it, so it uses the page file. So then it flushes all the memory from your memory to your page file, reboots and renames it to memory.dmp. So the page file needs to be big enough. It has to be able to host all the memory that you have. If you're taking a complete memory dump, it's a really big one nowadays. So an automatic memory dump works in a way that it keeps the page file in big enough size to house a normal kernel memory dump. And when a blue screen happens, it automatically expands your page file for the next 2 weeks to be bigger to house a complete memory dump. If nothing bad happens during the next 2 weeks, then it sizes down the page file again to conserve your hard disk space. And just for the final thought, you should always be able to blue screen your machines when you need to. That's the weirdest thing for me, as I'm doing this as a profession. Whenever I go somewhere and we have a place where we need to take the memory contents right now and start analyzing it, then we need to be able to create a memory dump. And people are thinking, like, why would you want to create a blue screen? We're trying to avoid blue screens. But it's something that you definitely need to be able to do. So nowadays, they've fixed it. Since 2 years now, they've fixed it. Now it works with USB keyboards as well. It didn't used to work with USB keyboards. Now it does. So there's basically instructions on the KB article how you can just, if you have it on your computer, and then you would just, like a computer having this, you would just press Control and then press 2 times scroll lock. That's probably a good place to stop the session, as I didn't remember to take the... No, I did. Just kidding. What you can do after that, if that when you have the memory dump, you have to have a simple path variable pointing to Microsoft Simple Server. And then you just take WinDBG, choose Open Crash Dump, and you get this, probably caused by... And if someone starts to talk to you about like blue screen analysis and how much you should learn it, I think that's the place where you stop. Then it's the developer's thing. But this one is very good and I use it a lot. Just a few days ago on a MacBook that was hanging, we used this to figure out it was actually the serial.sys that was hanging because he had wrong keyboard drivers or something like that running on the Mac. Okay. With that, I would like you to fill out the evals. It's the most important thing that we get out of this conference is evals, so please do fill in the evals. If you want to learn more stuff like this for free, I've got a really good newsletter. There's the link, and that's also the QR code for the same thing. And... I'm going to stick here. If you've got business cards, you can get t-shirts. But with this, I would like to thank you very much for joining this session. Thank you.